weeks clean.
Is it for the nerves catching up?
I don't know.
Well, it's wear and tear. Memories.
There are more than 90,000 students at the University of Toronto. This is the kind of number universities place prominently on websites. It communicates size, importance, opportunity. It also means that a student can spend 4 years surrounded by people and remain almost entirely unknown. A lecture hall can contain hundreds of students. An assignment disappears into a digital portal. A grade appears several weeks later. The university knows your student number. Whether anyone knows you is a separate question.
Okay, just because time is precious, I'm sure everyone's thinking this. Like, I think the objective is quite clear. Students want this program, and it's also benefited students quite a lot, right?
The hardest part of writing history is deciding where the story begins. Historians look for dates, founding documents, official decisions, the first meeting recorded in the minutes, the moment when something formally came into existence. But beginnings are rarely as simple as they appear. An institution may begin with a document. A community usually does not. Communities form gradually through conversations, shared questions, repeated encounters, and relationships that may seem insignificant at the time. Often, no one notices that a beginning has taken place. This is Buddhist Studies Footnotes. I'm Frances Garrett. I'm a professor of Buddhist studies at the University of Toronto, and for 5 years I served as director of the Buddhism, Psychology, and Mental Health program, an undergraduate minor that's usually just called BPMH. This series tells the story of that program. It's based on hundreds of letters from students, alumni, faculty members, staff, clinicians, community organizations, and scholars from Canada and abroad, alongside student surveys, institutional reports, curriculum documents, committee records, public communications, media coverage, and archival materials spanning the last half century. So despite the title of this podcast, this story is not really a footnote. At least, it wasn't a footnote in the lives of the students who found the program. And it shouldn't be one in the history of the university. For 20 years, I helped build and eventually direct the BPMH program. I knew its curriculum, I knew its institutional history. I knew the scholars who taught in it, the intellectual debates that shaped it, and the administrative structures through which it operated. I knew how it looked in calendars, reports, course descriptions, enrollment figures, and committee documents. I thought I knew its story. Then the students began to speak.
My name is Belle. I'm in my third year. I'm doing a double major in economics and cognitive science.
Belle studied economics and cognitive science. She was also a professional fencer. She'd spent years thinking about bodies, repetition, discipline, performance, and attention. Then she encountered BPMH.
I feel like BPMH for me was I learned about mindfulness. I learned about the roots of it, and I knew it was the right program for me.
Belle liked the courses, but what she talked about most is not the content.
I think it has a great community, and I think that's it's probably number one, the best thing about the program.
Belle compares BPMH with economics. Economics was established, comprehensive, everything a serious university program is supposed to be. It had theories, graphs, but something was missing.
I'm in economics, and economics, is, I would say, like, is a somewhat of a comprehensive and, like, a well-established program, though it lacks community in so many aspects that, like, my education is very severely impacted, in my opinion. But with BPMH, it's like the courses were super encompassing, but then the also community supported your learning in a way that was so influential.
Belle is making a claim that sounds obvious once she says it. Community affects learning. Universities often treat community as something that happens around education, a welcome week activity, a student life initiative, maybe a tent with free snacks. Belle says it was part of the education. Then she says something else.
I really wanted to enroll in it, like, and I just couldn't. And that's like, I just think I love this program.
The courses were still being taught. The professors were still there. Students were still sitting in the rooms. But Bell couldn't enter the minor. We'll come back to why. Radula came to the university with three interests: neuroscience, philosophy, meditation.
I'm in like the final stages of my fourth year of undergrad. I'm studying neuroscience with minors in philosophy and Buddhism, mental health, and psychology. And that was a collection of programs that I chose because I'm super interested in meditation. And I know that these are the ingredients that make up like a compelling and interdisciplinary exploration of meditation.
Universities are very good at organizing knowledge. This is one of their principal functions. Philosophy goes here, neuroscience goes there. Buddhist studies is in another building. Meditation may be present, but only after being translated into something that fits neatly inside a course calendar. The difficulty begins when a student's question refuses to respect the organization. What happens in the brain during meditation? Neuroscience. What is the self that meditates? Philosophy. Where do the practices come from? Buddhist studies. What does the experience feel like? Psychology. Maybe phenomenology. Maybe medicine. Radula needed a place where the questions could remain together. BPMH gave her one.
I think one of my aims in like developing this richer understanding of meditation, its implications, is also like to surprise myself with the applications that might emerge from this. And that there's definitely evidence for that in like my own journey. So the project that I'm working on right now is I've developed a meditative museum experience for the Royal Ontario Museum. And this would have never happened had I not taken all of these BPM courses that offered me like unique insights that I was able to integrate into this program itself.
Eventually, Radula created the Museum of Meditative Practices, a public research project exploring how contemplative traditions could be presented without reducing them to either religious curiosities or wellness products. The university likes stories like this once they're complete. A student arrives, finds a mentor, receives a fellowship, creates something original, appears on a podcast and a website. But from the student's perspective, the decisive moment comes earlier. Someone says, "Your question is not confused. The institution is." Alina studied bioethics, philosophy, sociology, and BPMH. She had encountered mindfulness outside the program. Like many students, she knew it as something practical, a technique for stress, focus, anxiety, maybe sleep, depending on the subscription plan. Then she studied its history.
And we were examining like Buddhism as a whole more, I would say, rather than like its benefits.
That distinction, Buddhism as a whole rather than just its benefits, would become important later. Outside the program, mindfulness often appears without much explanation. Pay attention to the breath, notice your thoughts, return to the present. Inside BPMH, students were asking different questions. Where did the practice come from? What was it originally for? What ethical teachings surrounded it? Who transformed it into a clinical intervention? What happened when it entered Western institutions? And why does a university sometimes prefer the breathing exercise to the history?
I think as a whole, learning about how in the West, we've adapted these practices into something that is more specifically used for like getting better rather than like the spiritual practice was very interesting.
Alina encountered the Buddhist concept of dukkha, usually translated as suffering or dissatisfaction.
Like specifically with dukkha and like how viewing life in that kind of way is a little bit liberating.
A philosophy of suffering made her feel liberated. That is not a standard wellness outcome. It would be difficult to fit into a 5-point satisfaction survey. The course did not promise to remove difficulty. It changed what difficulty meant. Since 2023, an administrative process has played out that's produced hundreds of pages of testimony about the BPMH program. Students and alumni have described what they learned, but also how they learned to listen, to question assumptions, to tolerate uncertainty, and to think across disciplinary boundaries. They describe classrooms in which Buddhism could be studied historically while also being placed in conversation with psychology, neuroscience, medicine, ethics, anthropology, and the study of lived experience. Some spoke about careers, others spoke about mental health. Some described research skills, contemplative practices, friendships, or a renewed sense of intellectual purpose. Together, their accounts formed an oral history of higher education, not an official history, not a single unified story, a chorus of partial memories, each one preserving something the institutional archive could not.
It feels like the connection between, especially students and professors, and like passing on relevant knowledge that can better the world. Like, what is the universe? Like, what is this institution like for, right? Like, we want to inform people like about the world and hopefully in a positive direction. Hopefully it's not just like neutral, just, you know, like hopefully we can like harness the information we learned here to make some kind of positive difference in the world. And I think BPMH does that very uniquely.
These students were speaking in meetings with administrators. Others wrote letters. Some described their experiences in interviews, videos, testimonials, and conversations. They spoke because they believed that something important was in danger of being lost. At first, I listened as the program's director. I listened for evidence, what courses had mattered, what forms of learning had students valued, what consequences might follow if the program disappeared. But as the testimonies accumulated, I began to hear something I hadn't expected. The students were not primarily describing a curriculum. They were describing relationships. They spoke about professors who had listened to them, classmates who had become friends, conversations that continued after lectures ended, student organizations, public events, research projects, contemplative practices, and communities that had extended beyond the boundaries of any single course. Again and again, they described the program not simply as something they had studied, but as something they had entered, something they had become part of.
Okay, good, yeah. So in addition to these more, right, of what we might call objective criteria, there's a sort of subjective, inherent subjectivity, right? There's an inwardness to consciousness that seems, it seems like science can't capture that.
I would say this is a different definition from their definition. I feel like that definition is kind of more like outward, like definition based on effects in the world, with I feel like another potential definition is like not actually based on any measurable effects, but only on like
yeah, okay, good, yeah, yeah. There's a tension definitely between thinking of consciousness as something that has effect or the effects of consciousness and its kind of inherent nature, right, the essence of it. Good. Good. I'm glad you folks brought these things up because I hopefully will get a little bit more conceptual clarity after the end of the lecture on this.
The students are trying to decide whether a plant is conscious. This is not going well. Every definition creates another problem. A nervous system, behavior, awareness, language. The discussion reaches the point where everyone knows less than they did when it began. In another class, Mark Miller asks students what made them smile that week. Then the conversation moves into predictive processing, attention, depression, and technology.
My area of focus is religious studies. One key takeaway was when we talked about the four nutriments. And I never thought about like volition as something you consume, but it kind of makes sense. It also makes sense in like predictive process.
Sure, it does.
Whatever you're intaking,
yeah,
also contributing to how you interpret everything. And
yeah,
that made me smile was like this morning was really cold, and I was like, it's so awesome to be indoors.
Hey.
Down too.
We always have an opportunity for gratitude in Canada when we're warm.
In BPMH courses, students may begin with meditation and then study the research.
Attention turns out to be a real powerhouse in this framework. So we need specialization, but not specialization at the expense of interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary integration.
The practice is not a break from scholarship. It's part of the question. If attention is the subject, students examine attention. If lived experience is the subject, experience becomes something to investigate, carefully, critically, but not from such a great distance that the thing itself disappears.
There was like a time in my life where I would say like I was depressed and wasn't in control of my life. But through like the techniques taught in a bunch of BPM courses, like I learned that just because I'm having a negative thought doesn't mean I have to identify with it. I can honestly say that BPMH program has honestly changed my life.
The phrase "changed my life" appears frequently in student letters. This is unfortunate because "changed my life" is also used to advertise mattresses, meal delivery services, and systems for arranging things in plastic containers. But the students are specific. They describe grief, addiction, academic pressure, family illness, career decisions, a first experience of belonging.
I think that this program provides ways for healing, and healing that's also centered in non-colonial ways of knowing and being, which are very important to support and, I think, continue in the university. In the BPMH program, I have been able to connect with my own goals of how I can support others in my field and also support the earth and the broader world and community in facing the anxiety that we feel when thinking about climate change and environmental issues.
BPMH is not therapy. It does not replace clinical attention. But in the students' accounts, education and well-being become difficult to separate. The academic questions matter because the questions are also happening in their lives. Universities maintain extensive archives. They preserve committee reports, correspondence, budgets, enrollment records, policies, calendars, and minutes. These records tell us what the institutions decided. They tell us what was approved, funded, suspended, created, or closed. They're indispensable, but they don't tell us everything. They rarely record the moment when a student first recognizes a question as their own. They don't preserve the conversation after class that changes the direction of a life. They don't easily capture trust, attention, mentorship, friendship, intellectual courage, or the gradual formation of a community. Those things belong to another kind of archive, an archive carried in memory, in habits, in relationships, in the lives people go on to lead. Listening to these voices, I began to understand that I had been looking for the program in the wrong place. I had looked for it in its courses, its requirements, its administrative home, its formal history. But maybe the program existed most fully in the relationships it made possible, in the space between a question and a response, between one discipline and another, between students and teachers, between the university and the communities with which it was engaged.
Hi, yes. My name is Natalie. I am an anthropology and political science student. And something that I notice in this Zoom that I've gained because of BPMH is the emotions are high. And even in the Zoom call, I can feel it through the computer. People are trying their best and we're all just like, we're going through the mud and we're trying to find the way through. So I appreciate everybody's work here, and to the administrators of New College, thank you. And I see that this is difficult for you too. So what I wanted to share about my experience at U of T is in anthropology and political science, I learned so much about the world. And I thought maybe in second year that I had learned it all, echoing Raghav, that I knew it all. And I just wanted to keep learning more. But then I found that things were very critical and not optimistic. I felt like we were looking at the world and taking it apart. And I felt very hopeless because I was like, what are we doing now? What we're talking about it. We're sitting around in this tower, whatever color we want to make it, and just picking apart and thinking that we're doing a good job. And I just felt so without ground, without foundation. And then when I took BPM courses, I was like, oh, this is what it is. We're supposed to come up with a goal an idea of what is good and what is right and what is helpful. And then we work toward that goal no matter what administrative, bureaucratic things are standing in the way. It's the goal. And then we walk towards it no matter how hard it is. So I hear all of the comments coming back to the students about the difficulties with setting up the university, the difficulties with hiring and not having enough faculty. But I keep coming back to what's the goal here? And if the goal isn't to increase learning and to change lives like mine, to set me on a new career path, if that's not the goal, then I think that the goal is something that the goal shouldn't be.
Maybe students wanted the university to recognize a form of educational life that its ordinary categories could not adequately describe, a community of inquiry, a place where knowledge emerged through relationships, a place whose significance could not be measured solely by counting courses, credits, graduates, or lines in a budget. That possibility became the question guiding this investigation. Not simply what happened to the Buddhism Psychology and Mental Health program, but what had grown there, and what might its story reveal about the kind of knowledge universities create, the communities they cultivate, and the responsibilities they carry toward the forms of intellectual life entrusted to their care.
I learned about it and I experienced it and I really, really wanted to take it.
Bell found a program that connected her interests and gave her a community. Then she discovered that the program was no longer accepting new students. One of the challenges of making this documentary is that it's very easy to misunderstand what happened in those classrooms. People hear the words Buddhism and meditation and immediately imagine that they know what kind of program this must have been. I probably would have done the same. But then the students start talking. One describes neuroscience, another psychotherapy, someone else philosophy, predictive processing, climate grief, medical ethics, trauma, artificial intelligence, compassion, attention, consciousness. By the end of the conversation, I realized that I had stopped trying to classify the program. Instead, I found myself asking another question. What kind of education allows all of those conversations to belong together? A door can remain physically open while becoming institutionally closed. Students can still enter the classroom. What disappears is the promise that the rooms connect. Before I explain why that happened, we need to understand what the program was attempting. Because the same thing that drew students to BPMH, its refusal to keep certain forms of knowledge apart, would eventually make it difficult for the university to decide where the program belonged. That's next time.